Hey, it's Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Thanks for joining me for this week's episode of the Sonic Scoop podcast. And today we're going to be talking about mixing and why you do not have to reinvent the wheel every time that you mix. It's true. When you mix, you don't necessarily have to mix from scratch. And I'm going to share with you a few potential best practices that you can use and the pros and cons of a few distinct ways of mixing. I'm going to be drawing a little bit on some interviews I did with a couple of great mixers, in particular, Manny Marroquin, one of my favorite mixers out there. Yes, that's how you say his name. It's not actually Marroquin, it's Marroquin. So don't yell at me in the comments below for saying his name wrong. Manny Marroquin, and also Jeff Ellis was another one who brings this up and talks about in his MixCon masterclass presentation, this idea of kind of starting with the client's mix. And a lot of great mixers do this, even if they're not specifically picking up where the client left off. Most of the great mixers I know actually start by listening to the client's rough mix most of the time. And this is a process I'm going to encourage you to do too. There are some alternative approaches here, and I'm going to give you some ideas about how you can better pick up where the client left off, because this is something that can be a little tricky. So let's get into this. The quick thing I got to do before we get into it is I've got to go begging for your likes. Don't make me beg. Don't make me beg, baby. Just give me a like. We'll just keep on going. Let's pretend that I never asked and you did it without me even asking. If you're on the YouTubes, hit the likes. And if you are listening to an audio-only version, consider giving us a rating and review on the podcast platform of your choice. It really does help. Also, big shout out to you for doing that. And I want to give you something totally for free, potentially. And that is we are giving away stuff. Once again, this week, we have a new giveaway out, this time with Universal Audio. We're giving away one of their new UAFX pedals. So definitely check that out at sonicscoop.com/contest. That's sonicscoop.com/contest. We have giveaways going on all the time. We give away more than $100,000 worth of gear every year. We've been doing that for like a decade. So go to sonicscoop.com/contest if you want to sign up to win one of those. Also, a big shout out to Soundtoys, sponsoring this podcast from the beginning. Try out anything they make for free for 30 days over at soundtoys.com. And big thanks to Focusrite, sponsoring this episode. I'm talking to a lovely Clarite interface. Has not given me a lick of trouble. The Clarite stuff is great, as is the entry-level Scarlett all the way up to their high-end RedNet series. Okay, onwards into the future. The actual meat of the episode. What do I mean by not having to reinvent the wheel when it comes to the mix and picking up where your client left off? I used to have a different perspective on this. I came from the analog days and the way back. You know, I first started on a 4-track and then I got an 8-track reel-to-reel and I worked in studios that had, you know, recording desks and stuff like that. And even though I did a lot of digital stuff, you know, I had a 18-channel kind of guerrilla digital rig early on, and I would record bands in their rehearsal spaces and at shows and, you know, go up to a lake house and rent it out and, you know, do a recording there, all that stuff. I still had some of this analog idea of, oh, you've got to start the mix from scratch, right? You bring up all the channels on the desk, and even if you're using a digital desk inside of Pro Tools, you just start from scratch on the mix. But that is not necessarily how the best mixers out there are working today. A lot of them treat the mix a lot more like a word processor, where you'd get like a Word document and like everything's there and you open it up and you just continue editing, or a Google Doc or a Google spreadsheet where it's just like a shared resource and you're picking up where the client's left off. And even more importantly, if you're not able to do that, and there's some obstacles that could get in the way, and I'll give you some workarounds on how you can do that. But I will say that there are some people like Manny Marroquin, who I mentioned early on, like Jeff Ellis, who worked with Frank Ocean for the longest time and now does a bunch of great pop mixes. These top tier mixers, a lot of them will try to get their clients' session files, literally open them up and start mixing where they left off. This requires, at the very high end, that these expensive mix engineers who are charging a lot of money own practically every plugin and every DAW there is. That's the reality of working in that way. But there are ways that you and I can do that, that I'll get into in just a minute. Before I do, though, I want to talk about the benefits of this approach. And the mixers who don't quite work that way, who I know who do it at a high level, still at least start with the client's rough mix and listen to it, because chances are the clients like their rough mix. sounds obvious, right? But they're probably not hiring you to totally reimagine their production. They're probably hiring you to take the effects maybe to another level, to give it a little bit more weight or pull or impact or intrigue, or just make it sound a little bit more kind of polished and special overall. And if you gave them back a mix that sounded exactly like their rough mix, but a little bit more impressive and maybe 20% better, chances are they'd be thrilled in most cases, especially if you're working with competent people who have worked on tracks that you're going to enjoy mixing, and it's not just a fix it in the mix, polish the turd scenario, right? Those scenarios do exist as well, and starting totally from scratch in those scenarios might make sense. Just get rid of everything they did because they're just stabbing in the dark and they don't know quite what they're doing yet. I mean, that's possible. You can run into those situations. But chances are that even in those situations, they have ideas about the general type of vocal effects they want to go for, about the general relationship of what's the most important instrument here aside from the vocals. Is it that guitar or is it that keyboard? They'll give you those hints. They'll give you those ideas. And starting by listening to the rough mix and figuring out what's one thing that if I improved in this rough mix, they'd be happy. And it might be that the kick drum just sounds too pillowy and you want to make it punchier and tighter. And if you just did that, they'd be happy. It might be that the vocal gets lost sometimes and, you know, is a little bit overbearing at other times. And if you just reapproach that, they'd be happy. It could be that the vocal effects aren't quite right or too bright or too cheesy, and just doing that would really bring things to life. Or it could be that you're not really hearing enough clarity and separation and definition between the main instruments, the things that aren't drums or bass or vocals, and you want to hear a little bit more definition and separation there so you can follow some of those interesting lines they're doing a little bit better. So what is one most important thing that you could take from the rough mix and make better? Better yet, what are two or three or maybe even up to five things? But once you start going past that five key things that you're trying to improve, it becomes really hard to keep track of. And you're maybe trying to fix things that don't need fixing. And this approach is great because it makes you end up respecting what your clients have already done and finding what's good in the production that they've already done. And also it'll make sure that you don't stray too far from their vision. If you use the rough mix as a little bit of a guide, of a template for, let's make it sound like this, but better. And I really recommend that process of listening to the rough mix and evaluating specifically and writing down what are the one, two, three, or even up to five things that if you could improve about that rough mix, it would just make the whole thing better. And then you could approach this totally from scratch. But what a lot of people will do these days, if they have the wherewithal, just get a session, own every plugin, own every DAW, so you can open up any session. But the other thing that'll work these days for a lot of people is to get exports, both wet and dry exports from your client for a mix, where you say to them, send me all of your wet stuff. Like, just send me your vocals with all of the effects on them, all of the processing, all of the compression, all of the EQ you did. Just print it. Print everything. And then also send me a print of everything with nothing on it. Totally dry. And this will help you in a situation where you can't just open up their session as is. You'll be able to open up kind of their session as is by loading in all the wet process stuff, and you basically would have their rough mix there, minus maybe some bus processing that may or may not occur. And then whenever any of those tracks is just too much, like the vocal, they overcompressed it, or the EQ, something seems funny, or there's too much distortion on it, then you have the dry track that you could pull in next to your wet vocal track and say, no, let's use the dry one and let's reimagine this from scratch now and just start EQing this dry one. So you have the option of taking just these dry unprocessed tracks and EQing them, compressing them from start, but this different approach of loading up all of the wet ones, picking up where they left off, and then adding to it, and maybe in some cases where you don't like what's going on the track, then pull in the dry track, I think that that's a good way of working in the modern world. Am I going to tell you this is the rule, the best practice, the thing you should do? No. If you already have a process or a system that works for you, stick with it. But if you haven't tried this, if you haven't asked your clients for this in the past, if you're finishing a mix for someone else, give it a try. Give it a try on at least one mix and see how it works for you. You might even try, if it's not too difficult, asking for stems as well, if you have a relatively sophisticated client, where you can even go back a step and say, give me all your stems and I'll work from those. And then where those don't work, then I'll put in a wet track. And where those don't work, then I'll put in the dry track. So is that cheating? No. If it sounds good, it is good. If you get to a good place, you're doing it the right way. And this might be a more efficient and better way to get to that idea of taking the rough mix and improving it. And it is a simplified version of what some of the top mixers out there are doing today, which is basically getting their client sessions and making sure they have every plugin that their client has, making sure that they can just load up the DAW that their clients use so they can pick up where their clients left off and sometimes back off on some of those effects when they need to. So I want to ask you, and answer me in the comments down below, or you can email me over at podcast@sonicscoop.com. Have you tried this approach before? How have you been doing it? What kind of files have you been asking for from your clients? Because I'm just putting the finishing touches on doing some new practical modules and new mixes for the full-length Mixing Breakthroughs course, and I found this approach to be really the most sensible way to work these days, to pick up where my clients left off and tweak from there. And I can make things sound pretty radically different, even if I'm starting with all their stuff baked in. Because let's be realistic here. Back in the day, when people were working in analog studios, they were doing a lot of processing as they went. They were applying often EQ and compression to tape. They were getting sounds when they went in, as they went along. If they were just using a 16 or 24 track machine or 8-track machine, they may have had to bounce tracks internally and they would have been doing a lot of processing as they went along that way. And people work that way today too. They'll often record a vocal and put some effect on that vocal, whether it's a telephone filter or distortion or a reverb or a delay. And then that effect, even an EQ, stays on for the whole rest of the production and informs every other choice they make. So although, yeah, they didn't record through that EQ plugin, they didn't record through that distortion plugin necessarily, they didn't record through that, you know, reverb necessarily, every single choice they made along the production process had that plugin or effect on there informing every other decision. And that happened again and again and again and again. So that's something that you can respect in your client's work. Say that every single decision has been made around this reverb. So why don't we at least start with the option of having this reverb there or this EQ there? And then if it's really not working in the mix, we can reimagine it. We can go back to dry tracks. Now, a couple, you know, technical considerations and caveats and complicating factors. One is, with wet tracks, do you want reverbs and delays baked right into the focal track? I mean, that's one way to do it. You can come up with your own best practices and preferences for your clients based on what you find is easiest for them and easiest for you to work at. One option is to have a totally dry vocal track and a totally wet vocal track, and you put them together in your DAW and you blend between the two of them. The other is to have a dry vocal track, a processed vocal track that is everything but time-based effects, say reverbs and delays, and then a third track, which would basically be your vocal, you know, reverb return, delay return, that kind of thing. So for some of these key elements that rely heavily on time-based effects, where you expect that you may want to tweak the time-based effect, say snare drum, say vocal, those being the two primary ones, maybe you would get your reverb or delay return as its own separate track rather than baked right onto the track. But that's up to what makes sense for you and the client. The other potential issue here is bus processing. If they're doing a lot of bus processing, do we print these tracks through that bus processing, through that group processing? In a lot of cases, probably yes. One other complicating factor is mix bus processing. Should it be going through mix bus processing? I'd say for these purposes, probably not, but doing mix bus processing properly is actually really important for creating really good stems. So if you wanted to do a mix from stems, or if you wanted to create a stemmed version of your mix, then it is important to have kind of all of your track stems be going through bus processing so that it really does sound like your final mix. And in that case, you need to end up doing like a sidechain kind of thing where when you print your drum stem, it's going through your main mix bus processing, but that bus processing that's happening on the main mix is still receiving audio from all the other channels in your mix. So when the bass makes your compressor clamp down, it'll still be doing that even when you have the bass muted so you can just print out your stems. It's a slightly more complicated idea. I should probably do a whole episode about that, but it probably won't be a podcast episode because I'll probably have to give you some visual examples about how to make that work in your session. It's actually fairly simple. The idea being that basically all of your tracks go to one particular subgroup that is going to be used to trigger the sidechain input of your bus processing. So when you mute those additional tracks, they're still feeding into the sidechain, even though they are kind of muted out. So all of your tracks are always affecting your bus processor, even when you just have one stem subgroup of stuff soloed out. And that's an important thing to do if you're creating a mix from stems. But for this idea of getting dry and wet stuff to complete a mix on, I don't think that's as essential. I basically think that your clients could take all of their main stereo mix bus processing off. You really want to come up with your own written, simple document that you can send to your clients that you think is going to be easy for you to deal with and easy for them to deal with, where you spell this stuff out. I don't want to give you totally 100% precise ideas here, though I'd love to hear your precise ideas in the comments down below about how this should best be handled. But in doing some mix updates for the course, I found this to be an extremely useful approach to get both completely dry and completely wet tracks from the client. So I can basically put in all those wet tracks and come pretty close to recreating the rough mix exactly as it is, start mixing from there, and where I'm running into trouble and I don't quite like some of the sounds that they've gotten and I feel like they need to be changed and we need to go back a step, then I have all their dry tracks there as well. And in some situations where there's been problems where I feel like I'm not quite getting everything from the client properly and I'm having trouble recreating a really essential sound that might have relied heavily on effects, in those cases, I'll say, hey, could you also send me stems of this session? Because I've run into a problem. If you're dealing with really savvy clients who can just easily print out stems too, and that's something that they do normally, then you might ask for those stems right up front. But I think this general approach, this general idea is going to save you a lot of time and make your clients a lot happier by respecting their vision and then just taking their vision up a notch rather than reinventing everything from scratch on every single session you do. I don't think that's the most efficient way to work, and I don't think it's the most modern way to work either. Again, let me know in the comments down below, what are your best practices? What are your thoughts around this? What kinds of problems have you been running into? And what have been some of the best solutions for you in your own work? Let us know in the comments down below or shoot me an email at podcast@sonicscoop.com. Thanks for hanging out with me for this episode of the Sonic Scoop Podcast. I got some free stuff for you. Remember, you can enter that giveaway where we're giving away a Universal Audio Effects pedal over at sonicscoop.com/contest. That's sonicscoop.com/contest. I also have a free workshop on mixing for you called The 5 Habits of Every Great Mixer. These are the 5 things that every amazing mixer who I've studied, interviewed, worked alongside, seen work, does. And all of them do at least 4, and most of them do all 5. So check that out, sonicscoop.com/mixhabits. That's sonicscoop.com/mixhabits. These are things you should be doing in every single mix. Also got a primer on mastering for you, also totally for free. You can get that at sonicscoop.com/mastering101. That's sonicscoop.com/mastering101. If you want to go deeper, we've got the full-length courses, Mixing Breakthroughs. I'm working on a course update for that. They'll be coming out shortly. We're adding in a whole bunch of new mixes for you guys to try out along with me. And we've also got the full-length course, Mastering Demystified, possibly one of the most useful things I've ever done in my life. Both of them, really. You can check those out at mixingbreakthroughs.com and masteringdemystified.com. Last but not least, big shout out and thanks to Focusrite for making this Claret interface I'm speaking to right now. And big thanks to Soundtoys for sponsoring this episode of the podcast and every episode since the beginning. Try out anything they make for free for 30 days over at soundtoys.com. Thanks again for hanging out with me. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. See you next time.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
All because of a fancy bike?
It's not just a bike. Peloton makes treadmills too.
Nah, all treadmills are the same.
Our treadmills can adjust speed and incline automatically, so you never break your stride. Whether you're squeezing in a power walk or training for a marathon, Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try the Peloton Tread risk-free with the 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.